Ileana, first of all, thank you so much for coming back on with us. I have to say, the last time you were on with us, one of our favorite conversations we've ever had on the show.
Oh, my goodness. Thank you. Well, I'll try to top myself.
Well, I have no doubt that you'll be able to do that. Let's talk about what's going on this month, the third year of this initiative with TCM Trailblazing Women. It's been so wonderful. I mean, I knew a little bit about Ruth Gordon and Betty Comden, but to learn about some of the real pioneers like Jeannie McPherson, Bess Meredith, and the fact that women have been instrumental in filmmaking since the very beginning.
Yes, especially. And what I love about doing the show is every year I learn a new name. And for me, one of the names that really stood out, June Mathis, who discovered Rudolph Valentino, who created him, created his image, produced Ben-Hur from 1926. Ben-Hur written by a woman, Bess Meredith produced by a woman. You know, and it's this epic, it's the largest. You know, I think it had a cast of about 100,000 people shot over a four-year period. I mean, the best of what the motion picture business, you know, was just crazy.
And you've had a chance to talk to some pretty influential and important women in the industry as well.
Yes. Again, another highlight for me this year, Callie Curry, who I so admire, you know, Academy Award-winning screenwriter. Of Thelma and Louise, and so much a part of, I think, you know, a discussion that's going on now with women in film. So Callie Curry, but editors like Lindsay Klingman, who edited One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and worked with Milos Forman, and Marianne Brandon, who's, you know, again, worked with J.J. Abrams, Stephanie Elaine, producer of Hustle and Flow, and Leslie Dixon wrote all these great rom-coms, adapted Mrs. Doubtfire. So, again, it's great to go this year behind the scenes with all these people.
We've got what we call, as friends of the show, our main mafia that's working in Hollywood, people like Katie Azleton and Caitlin Fitzgerald, Anna Kendrick, Gita Palopoli, and so many of them are involved in several different aspects of the industry. Is it even, I mean, obviously it helps anybody in the business, but is it even more vital that women can wear different hats to achieve success?
Well, I think that what we've shown on the show is that women were always wearing different hats. Mm. You mentioned Ruth Gordon. She started out as an actress. She did plays. She wrote books. She collaborated with her husband and wrote screenplays. And then she went back to acting later in life. Virginia Van Upp, who is a producer who worked uncredited under Harry Caan, you know, wrote you know, most of Gilda uncredited. So I think that, you know, women are always behind the scenes, even in a film like Taxi Driver. The editor was a woman, Marsha Lucas, Julia Phillips was a woman. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily think of Taxi Driver as a sensitive female picture. But again, it just shows that somewhere along the line, we got this divide of like a woman's movie or a man's movie. And I think that the best movies are a combination of the two. And again, example is a film like Taxi Driver. Another example is a producer we highlight, Kathleen Kennedy, who I've had the privilege of working with, who's just been an incredible producer and now a studio head.
What's coming up on Monday night's installment?
Coming up this Monday, we have Stephanie Elaine. We've had last week was Callie Curry. The first week we had Leslie Dixon. We were talking about writers, you know, from Dorothy Parker, again, who, you know, needs to be, you know, reevaluated. I think it's like we're so quickly about to forget someone. And what we were talking about with Dorothy Parker is, again, you know, starting a kind of a witty, you know, she was the first sort of witty, urbane scriptwriter, kind of a through line from somebody like Oscar Wilde that then you could trace to somebody like Nora Ephron or Tina Fey. But coming up, we have Stephanie Elaine, and we're going to be focusing on female producers.
All of this happening, of course, while the scandal hits the news about Harvey Weinstein and the challenges that people knew about, but not to the degree that they've had to deal with all these years. Is this the start of hopefully creating a better environment for women in the industry?
I think it obviously it is. It does have a kind of wall coming tumbling down feeling. You know, there's going to be a lot of pain and heartache right now. And, you know, one of the things that I've tried to do, again, is just to, I'm glad that the show is here, to focus on some positive things of men and women working successfully together, you know, and hopefully, again, the idea is that, you know, that we've had the majority of these, you know, great experiences and collaborations, and hopefully that will, you know, that will continue. And obviously there's no place for that kind of mentality. But it's going to be a lot of pain and heartache right now. But I think looking back over Hollywood history, it's good that these conversations are having, not so much in the, you know, in the terrible context, which is current. But again, one of the women we're focusing on is, you know, this woman, Virginia Van Upp. And, you know, I mean, again, like, she just never really got her due. And, you know, I pulled a story on her, you know, and the headline was Paul Bunyan was a sissy compared to Virginia Van Upp, gal producer, whose achievements have earned her the label Dainty Dynamite. You know, so that must not have been fun for her, you know, to be. So I think that one of the great things about the show, too, is highlighting all sorts of oppression and honoring these women. And, you know, we don't think of Gilda. I never thought of Gilda as a movie that was really the force behind it was Virginia Van Upp. I mean, that was completely her project from start to finish. So it's a way to reevaluate these great movies and look for more movies that, you know, that these women have been involved with. I mean, that was one of the great things was after about June Mathis, it's like you discover all these other films that they've done. And I think that I've tried to just take a positive approach to, you know, some of the heartache that's been going on.
We're talking with Ileana Douglas here on Downtown. There are more opportunities, certainly, for women behind the camera as directors, but is there still a perception among a lot of people that any film directed by a woman must be a quote-unquote woman's movie?
Well, again, this is something that became, you know, and that's why I thought it was important to have somebody like Callie Curry on. The first time the phrase chick flick was used, it was meant to be a positive term in terms of Thelma and Louise as a kind of an empowering phrase. It then became a kind of derogatory phrase of like, oh, it's a movie for women about women. And that's how so it became a negative stereotype. But again, going to the past, of all these movies and looking at them, there was no such thing as, you know, a male movie, a female movie. There were female stars, but there were writers behind it. I mean, another great example of the woman that we highlight is J. Preston Allen, you know, who wrote the screenplay of Marnie, The Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and then the movie that we show is Cabaret. But she went on to write Prince in the City and had a, you know, a really great collaboration with Sidney Lumet. And so, you know, Prince in the City, again, not a woman's picture. So I think that, you know, you've got to take, you know, hopefully what I love about doing the show is taking away that stereotype of, okay, well, we have to get a woman director for this. We have to get a male director for this. This is a woman's story. That's a man's story. Instead of look at the body of work. What does this, you know, woman bring to the picture, and why would she be good for this kind of a film? And it takes a little bit of imagination, I think.
Our current political climate is also a reminder, too, that women have always faced challenges when stepping into what have been viewed as traditional male arenas, and you experienced that in your own family. Of course, with your grandmother getting attacked by Richard Nixon back in the late 1940s.
Yeah, that's true. That's, well, we've always got that. You know, that's women being silenced is you know, nothing new where I come from. But you know, you can't let it get into your psyche. You have to kind of persevere. And I think that if you believe in the story, you know, the story will get told. I do think that women have to step up to the plate and not be afraid. And also, big thing that I learn every year is to take credit for what you have written and write it down. You know, men traditionally have been very, very good at, you know, obscuring the input that women have made on their films. That's why we do the show every year, to highlight, you know, to highlight the work of somebody like Dee Dee Allen, you know, again, the editor for Bonnie and Clyde and so many other movies. And, you know, Dee Dee Allen basically created a modern form of editing with Bonnie and Clyde that every other editor since then has kind of copied. And I think that if you can look at the past and you know, and alongside that, Arthur Penn was the person who gave her the job, and Warren Beatty defended her, you know, when Jack Warner, who was, you know, very sexist, he didn't want her to be on the movie. You know, somebody like Warren Beatty stepped in and they protected her. And so I think, again, it's always in this collaboration of, you know, of working together. That's when things, I think, work the best.
I went back and reread, and I love the book, but both times I've read it, I blame Dennis Hopper, which is just such a wonderful read. And a story, the last time you were on, we talked a lot about the book, but we didn't get to discuss the story, and I wonder if you could share some of it, of your encounter with Rudy Valli.
Oh, well, my encounter with Rudy Valli from a very young age was when I was, I had gotten a little job at a dinner theater. One of the, you know, I lied about my age and got this little job working there. And I was a kind of a quirky kid, so I was one of the few people who actually knew who Rudy Valli was. But I would watch him, you know, kind of night after night, just really being impressed with his performance. And I was backstage, you know, trying to watch the performance. And I think he just mistakenly, because it was such a low-rent theater, I was standing there and he was kind of struggling with his costume, and I came to his aid, and I suddenly, a bell went off in my head, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll be here tomorrow night. And that way I'll pretend like it's a role, and I'll somehow, like, I'm here with your coat, Mr. Valli. And so, you know, we established a little bit of a rapport. And what I mean by that was me saying, great show, sir. And him saying, thank you. And then like walking by, but, you know, but by the end of the week, you know, I guess he saw some little spark in me or something. I really enjoyed the show. He brought me back to his dressing room and played, you know, put on this tape machine. And I was listening, and I thought it was The Ocean. I didn't know what he was playing. And he said, do you know what that is? And I said, is it The Ocean? And he said, no, it's My Applause. I listen to it every night, you know. And it was such a poignant kind of a reminder of, you know, no matter where you are, that this idea that if you could play back the applause and the joy that you've given people in your life, it's not a bad way, you know, to live your life. And so it always kind of stayed with me, the sort of the poignancy of that. He was quite old at the time, still out there, you know, plugging. And I've always had a soft spot for older entertainers, you know, just to see, you know, what they've gone through. And again, somebody like him, who is, you know, one of the top, you go in his day, the top people in America in terms of fame. And then, you know, cut to, you know, 1979, and he's at a broken down dinner theater in the middle of the woods listening to his applause. So, you know, it's always like a gentle reminder to just like, it's all about the journey.
Well, and I was struck in reading it about how hard he worked in that dinner theater, because 2 or 3 years before that, I was in college and he came up here to the University of Maine because he had had a big hit recording the Maine Stein song back in the 1920s. And they decked him out in the raccoon coat and had an old car. Yep. And he came out and had to be in his mid to late 70s at the time. Oh. And even then did that song as if he was at the Hollywood Bowl.
That's it's funny you say that, because that's how I felt. It was like once he got out there, you know, and sang, in particular, as I wrote in the book, my fate was this, you know, a vagabond lover. You know, there wasn't a dry eye in the house. You know, it just was. Here was a man who invented a style of singing called crooning, and somebody like Frank Sinatra listened to that, and Bing Crosby, and you know, it's the very root of what show business is, and I've always been a kind of a student of that. But and it's good to remember the name Rudy Valley.
One of the giants that you became friends with through the years, we lost not too long ago, Jerry Lewis. Can you talk about your relationship with Jerry and why he felt a special kinship with you?
I can only describe it in the same way that. You know, my love for these performers and my respect for their contributions, you know, you can't be taught that. You just know it. You know, people always say to me, how do you know so much about movies? It's like, well, I started when I was about 4. So, you know, it becomes kind of a way of life. And I was always a fan of Jerry's movies, particularly some of the ones he did with Frank Cashlin, the color films. You know, Cinderfella, Nutty Professor, you know, the Ladies' Man, those are some of my favorites. And his musical contributions were always what got me, because I love music. And I always thought he was such a great dancer. And so I think initially when we first met, you know, we had in common, I was working for Turner Classic Movies, and we would just talk about movies because, you know, I'm going to ask him questions about Jack Benny because he knew Jack Benny. And I think that, you know, when you spot in someone that they have a genuine interest in learning and becoming a better filmmaker and a better artist, I think that was, you know, what he saw in me initially. And then it just turned into just a great, you know, great friendship where you could, I miss him every day, where I think I can't pick up the phone and get words of wisdom from somebody like Jerry Lewis. You know, somebody like Jerry has, you know, they've seen it all. They've been on the top and they've been on the bottom and they've come back and, you know, they are again at the very roots of show business, which is coming out of vaudeville. And once people like him are gone, that's it. So it's kind of like, you know, when Jerry Lewis calls you, you pick up the phone. Like, you never, I mean, I remember, I think, doing press for Trailblazing Women, and I said, oh, there's just one thing. If Jerry Lewis calls me, I'm just going to have to step out. And they were like, what? No, but we're live on a radio show. And I was like, I'm sorry, it's Jerry Lewis. You know, so you just, you know, it was a privilege to spend time with him, interview him, and even recently speak at his memorial. It was like one of the great honors of my life, of getting to know him and learning from him, not only as a filmmaker, but as a human being.
Well, it's a privilege for us to have a chance to talk with you again. Love the series Trailblazing Women on TCM. Your podcast is absolutely terrific as well, and it's a delight for us to have you back on.
Oh, thank you. Anytime.